So often we call them behaviors related to dementia when it really is pain. And if we can manage that pain better, we would see such a reduction in behaviors. And you know where we might be able to do that better, but the assessing, like you said, I think is the first step.
Hey out there, welcome back to the Nursing Home Abuse Podcast. My name is Rob. I'll be your host for this episode. Today we are talking about pain assessment tools that can be used for non-verbal or dementia. Let me do that again. 3, 2, 1. Hey out there, folks. Welcome back to the Nursing Home Abuse Podcast. My name is Rob. I'll be your host for this episode. Today we are talking about pain assessment tools for non-verbal nursing home residents, how we can parse out certain behaviors that are related to pain versus being related to the progress of the disease. But we're certainly not having that conversation alone. We had the fantastic Dr. Nicole Dawson on to walk us through this process. All right, there. Before we get into that, we are now headed into our nursing home regulation question of the week. And another opportunity for you to blatantly ignore the chance to win a Nursing Home Abuse Podcast coffee mug. That's right. A porcelain Nursing Home Abuse coffee mug, perfect for drinking whatever you want out of it. Or, as I've mentioned before, you can use it to hold stuff. Like, put it on your shelf, put some pins in it, put your coins in it, put it on the shelf like your grandma used to do. How do you win that, you might ask? Well, it's extremely difficult. You're going to go to our TikTok, which is at Justice for Residents. You're going to look for the question of the week video. You'll know it out of the thousands of videos on there because it's going to be the one that has a cup of black coffee on it. Okay. You're going to click on that. You're going to comment your answer as well as your go-to coffee order. My go-to coffee order is black coffee. I really don't understand this question. Okay. So your go-to coffee order might be one of those things like a latte or whatever you drink. I don't know. Macchiato, frappuccinos, things like that. Whatever that is. I hope it's not. I hope it's just coffee. But whatever your go-to coffee order is, put that in the comments as well as your answer. And you will be randomly selected to win that coffee mug. The winners are announced every Sunday on our website, which is shinkfirm.com/podcast/giveaway. Prize ships at the end of the month. And again, I guess coffee order, whatever it is, whatever you like. You know, I'm just kidding. I'm not really kidding. Like, I don't understand the concept of these extremely sugary drinks that are cold for adults that you get at a coffee shop. At some point, I'm assuming that these things outsell coffee itself, because when I order a coffee, that seems to take 35 minutes. But you know, it's because the person in front of me has ordered something that has 76 ingredients in it. Anyway, I digress. I'm being an old man right now. Okay, difficulty level this week, folks, I'm going to say is medium. So if you get this right, go to Starbucks and get one of those ridiculous drinks. Get two pumps of candy in it extra for yourself. Under 42 CFR 483.70H4, how long do facilities have to retain residents' medical records? Is it A, for a period of 10 years after discharge, B, 5 years after discharge if there's no state law requirement, or C, 1 year after discharge if there's no state law requirement? And that answer is B. The nursing home is required to keep a resident's records for as long as that particular state requires, but if there's no state law requirement, it has to be kept for at least 5 years. All right, now it's time to get into the meat and potatoes of the episode. As I mentioned, we're having a conversation about pain assessment tools for non-verbal residents, but we're not having that conversation alone. We have the fantastic Dr. Nicole Dawson on. Dr. Dawson, PT, PhD, is an associate professor at the University of Central Florida and a director of the Alive Lab, a board-certified geriatric physical therapist, emeritus? How do I say that? Emeritus? She's really smart. With 20 years of experience, she researches non-pharmacological interventions for adults with chronic disease and dementia. Dr. Dawson has received national recognition for her academic and clinical contributions and leads Golden Age Consultants, providing education and training on aging and geriatric rehabilitation. We're so happy to have her on the show. Dr. Dawson, welcome to the show.
Well, hi, Rob. Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
So I think for me, the first question that I would have for you is, if we have a long-term care resident who is care plan for pain control, pain management, but also is cognitively impaired, has dementia, how does that nursing staff know the difference between baseline cognitive behaviors versus behaviors that are caused by the pain?
I think that that is a great question. And it's one that we're actually trying to figure out, because research with this patient population, you can imagine, is a little bit challenging just because of their, you know, ability to tell us exactly what is going on inside. You know, we always chuckled, you know, as a healthcare provider, you want to have like these superpowers. And one of mine is, I would love to be able to get into my patients' bodies and feel what they're feeling. It would just make me it would just make life so much easier, but we can't. So we have to rely on what we know. And I think your question is a good one, because, you know, we get frustrated as healthcare providers, as families, because we think that our loved one or our patient is in distress because of these behaviors. I think what we need to understand is the disease process itself. And what I've come to find is, I think most healthcare providers, even families and attorneys, all of the people don't really have a great understanding of the disease. And what we know, Alzheimer's disease is probably the most common form of an irreversible dementia that we see. And behaviors, these neuropsych behaviors, they don't come out because of the disease for a really long time. So when we're seeing them kind of early and in the moderate stage, it usually is because of something else. So I typically will tell folks it's usually an unmet need, and that need could be pain, you know, and so they're not always able to tell us, you know, what's going on, but it is something that we need to assess. You know, are they having pain? And then there's different ways that we can look at whether or not they're having pain. And then if we can kind of rule out, if you will, that there is no pain, then we might look to see that this is some other type of neuropsych behavior, maybe related to depression or frustration, or something going on in the brain. But I think instead of assuming that it's because of the disease, we need to assume it's from something else, rule that out, and pain is one of those things, and then maybe say it's a neuropsych behavior because of the disease.
That makes sense to have a default position to be, let's rule pain out first, because I mean, clearly that's, yes, you know, we want to make sure that somebody's, you know, as pain-free as possible. What are some of those more common in your experience? What are some of the more common behaviors that represent pain in nonverbal cognitively impaired individuals?
Another great question. Vocalization, I think, is one. And sometimes I think being able to determine, is it at rest? Are we seeing these behaviors at rest, or are we seeing them with movement, change of position? You know, so if we're moving someone and they're moaning and grimacing and vocalizing, then it's probably pain, you know. But also, I'm sure you're aware, and I'm sure, you know, everybody that's listening is aware, that we don't always position folks in our nursing homes in the best, most comfortable way. You know, they've been laying in bed for a few hours, or they're sitting in their chair and they're really scooted down. And so also looking at, sometimes it's common sense, Rob, would I be comfortable, you know, in the position that they're in? And so sometimes we think about an 85-year-old patient who, maybe has some arthritis or has some tightness or has some changes in their skin. And so the position that they're in, they're not comfortable. And so can we shift them, change position? Does that change some of those vocalizations? Those are some of the behaviors that we see. Also withdrawing from not wanting to move. If people are hurting, they might try to stay still because moving their leg or moving their neck or moving their back, it's not comfortable.
What are some of the more common assessment tools that a nursing home might put in place? I'm sure there's many of them.
There are.
So what are some of the more common ones that you've seen in your experience?
So probably the most common one that I've seen, we call it the pain AD. Or the different people call it different things. That's just what I call it. And it's a checklist. And you score it, so typically when we do our visual analog scale or our verbal scale, it's what's your pain level from 0 to 10. So what I like about the pain AD is it actually scores it from 0 to 10. And so you can kind of give it that 0 to 10 feeling just by looking at behaviors. So you're going to see, are they moaning? Are they vocalizing? Are they trying to pull away? Are they grimacing? These types of things, and you score that. So I think that's one of the more common ones that I see. And like I said, like there's tons of others.
Now, how important, I understand the concept of if a person is in an uncomfortable position, they maybe they vocalize if you try to move them, or they don't want to move. But talk about, what are some of the other behaviors or some other characteristics of pain? So for example, I see the pain ID. Maybe you look at how fast they're breathing, for example.
Yeah, so we have some physiological responses to pain. So we'll see increases in heart rate. You'll see an increase in blood pressure. If the pain gets really significant, we'll actually have what's called a diaphoretic response. So in this actually autonomic nervous system response, well, they'll start sweating, they might actually lose their urine. There's different things that we can see that if they're in significant amount of pain, that you'll see some physiological responses. So the other things we've been talking about, the moaning, the grimacing, yeah, that's, more them trying to tell you that it's hurting, but the body will also tell us that they're in pain.
That makes absolute sense. So in your experience, does the nursing home typically would have one pain assessment tool, or is it the pain assessment tool depends on the resident?
So I think when we're talking about cognitively impaired folks, typically I have seen that a nursing home will adopt a protocol for everyone to follow. Typically our visual analog or our, numeric pain rating scale is still the most common. And I do think that because of our lack of knowledge with folks that have cognitive impairment, we try to use it on people that we shouldn't be using it on. You can also use sometimes if they can point or respond, the FACES scale is also validated in folks with dementia. But again, if they're nonverbal and they're more severe, I don't see the pain AD used often, I'll be honest with you, Rob, but I do see people document the behaviors, but they won't actually use the assessment tool. To answer your question, I think people try to adopt a single one across nursing homes, but I don't see the pain AD used very much in the practice that I did, and now in, my medical record review and different things.
I see. So I guess if from what I understand you saying is that nursing homes are basically developing their own protocols, not necessarily using a specific tool like the pain aid.
And I think, again, it comes back to, when I go out and I teach to nurses and therapists and other people, it's a lack of knowledge. And so I would love to see people using this more, and they try, because again, you'll see them saying, no pain behaviors noted, or they'll say, patient is grimacing, or, they're withdrawing from movement, because of pain, but they're not actually assessing it like I think it would behoove them to do.
So I guess that leads to, for example, we have, like, with pressure injury, risk assessments. We have the Braden scale, mm-hmm. which is pretty much universal, right? And so we can accrue data. We can see like, okay, maybe we need to fix this or whatever. But I feel like from what you've described, because there's no real one universal pain assessment tool for nonverbal residents, it's tough to, you know, figure out what's working, what's not working.
And that's what the research shows. Like when you look at the systematic reviews and different things, it basically says exactly what you said is we need to find a common gold standard pain assessment for, you know, this patient population because we don't have one. So I think at the last look that there's like probably 16 different ones. Again, I think there's one, the PACSLAC is common, but that, you know, it's good, but it's just a checkbox. It's got a lot. It's just a checklist and it's got a lot. So it can feel overwhelming, which is also why I like the Pain AD because you get a nice score and it kind of mimics this 0 to 10 pain scale. But again, it's not the universally accepted measure. And so I agree. I wish that we would be able to really adopt one and do more research on it. Because then I think once we've adopted that, then we can move into how are we doing with pain management? Because I don't think we're doing very well with this patient population, because it goes back to your first question. I think so often we call them behaviors related to dementia when it really is pain. And if we can manage that pain better, I think that we would see such a reduction in behaviors. And there's lots of reasons, and we can certainly talk about it if we have time, about some of that pain management and, you know, where we might be able to do that better. But the assessing, like you said, I think is the first step.
Okay, so that's a good point. So let's say that we are in a facility that uses Pain AD, okay, and you get a number. What next? Like, what are the interventions? What are the things that we're going to do?
So, you know, what the research is showing is we typically, just like our healthcare field does right now, is we rely on pharmacological management, right? We give them drugs. We give them a pain pill. We give them, the problem with dementia is when you put a patient who has Alzheimer's disease on a narcotic, it's not a great idea all the time, you know, and we over-medicate for pain so frequently instead of just trying some Tylenol or, you know, to seeing if that will help. The other thing we don't do enough of is non-pharmacological interventions, simple things like positioning and turning. And, you know, can we get physical occupational therapy involved to see if we can make some modifications to their wheelchair to help them be more comfortable? Can we actually get them on a stretching program? Can we get them walking a little bit more? Can we do things to help them move? Because movement is probably one of the best things we can do for pain in this patient population, because most of their pain is because they're stiff, you know, whether it's in their joints or in their muscles. I mean, think about, again, if you laid on your couch or in your bed for 8 or 10 hours, you'd probably be a little uncomfortable too. Or if you sat in the same position and didn't reposition yourself for 2 or 3 hours, you know, so sometimes getting them up and moving is really all we need to do. So I always say geriatrics takes a village, and dementia certainly takes a village to really be able to care for this patient population. And I think, you know, nursing has shouldered the burden, I think, on their own. And I would love to see them reach out to their colleagues a little more and, you know, get PT, get OT involved, get activities involved, get other people involved to get these folks out of bed and moving. And I think we'd see some pretty big changes.
That makes so much sense. Like, rather than the default be the pill, pain pill of or an opioid. Okay, well, let's see. Like, all right, if we just make them more comfortable, is that going to do it? Like, that just makes more sense that you run down a different checklist before ultimately deciding on a pharmacological intervention. Before I lose this train of thought, in your research and your experience, What is the percentage roughly of long-term care residents that that are experiencing pain that needs to be managed?
A lot. I mean, I would say, and it's not even my, like, it's there again, there's systematic reviews, meta-analyses. I mean, at least 60 to 70%.
Yeah, so this is a huge chunk of people.
It is. You know, the problem that we see is giving them a pill is fast. It's quick. You know, I can pop a pill, they can be good. Doing all the things that we just talked about takes time, it takes collaboration of care. And I've come to find that that's probably one of the biggest barriers. However, what I try when I go out and I teach and I talk to folks is the juice is definitely worth the squeeze. I'm going to steal that from a colleague of mine, is even though it takes a minute to do this collaboration, in the long term, the patient is going to reduce behaviors. They're going to be more comfortable. You'll probably see reductions in pressure sores, contractures, other things. So putting in a little bit of work up front, you definitely get a pay, you know, down the road, because the patient's just happier, more comfortable. You know, they're going to decline less quickly. Now, what we don't have, Rob, is the research to back up what I just said, you know, because we're not there yet. But I could just tell you from my 20 some years of experience is it just makes sense that if people are up and they're moving and they're comfortable, they're going to do better. They're going to be happier. You know, they're going to have blood flow. They're not going to contract. Their bed sores are going to be less. So all of the benefits of reducing, you know, just sitting and laying and doing these things and getting this collaborative approach is not only going to help pain, but it's going to help so many other things. You know, and let me make one other comment that I saw so much when I was practicing is the default is also when we're giving Tylenol or things is we do it what we call PRN, right? We give it as needed. So you'd see that Tylenol PRN for pain. Well, a patient with dementia is never going to ask for PRN pain meds. They're just not. And so, you know, what we would talk about with the nursing staff is can we get the Tylenol scheduled? You know, and so that way we're staying in front of pain. If we think that we need some Tylenol, doesn't need to necessarily be an opioid per se, but let's see if we can schedule some Tylenol with that patient. If we know that they have chronic arthritis, chronic back pain, if they have a diagnosis, you know, that would require them, you know, to have some pharmacological pain management, let's not PRN this in our patients with dementia, especially when they're nonverbal. It's not like they're going to hit the button and say, I'm having pain. And so now if they haven't had pain meds for 3 days, we're so far behind the curve. Of course, they're in pain. So if we can get ahead of it, you know, and schedule that, you know, we also would see in my practice that those patients were much more comfortable.
You mentioned it takes a village for this, and I agree. That seems to be a through line on this podcast of staffing. In the last couple minutes, Dr. Dawson, can you talk to us about the importance, speaking of the village, the importance of continuity of care with respect to documentation? Like, what role does documentation play in being able to make the determination, let's do the Tylenol, for example?
I think it's critical, Rob. And, you know, coming, you know, my discipline, I'm a physical therapist. And in nursing homes, one of the biggest frustrations I would have is PT, even if they're in-house, they don't share the same documentation system as the nursing staff, you know, so they can't see each other's documentation. And so if I'm writing something in my therapy notes about pain or that, you know, we tried a modality, a non-pharmacological intervention, or that we want to do, you know, we tried a special cushion or we did these things, we have to go and figure out a way to report that out to the nursing staff and then get the nursing staff to get that into their documentation, because they don't talk, usually those systems don't talk to each other. So it's a whole level of training now that we have to do as the therapists and to get that down to the nursing assistants. And, you know, nobody reads the documentation that's in the electronic medical records. And so I, you know, when you talk to nursing, they rely on what we still paper pencil flow sheets. And so the continuity of documentation is so important, but it doesn't exist. Like when I'm doing medical record reviews, you know, typically all I get are the progress notes from nursing. I'm like, well, that's not where the meat and potatoes of the day-to-day care is from the nursing assistants. That's in a separate document. And when you're talking about eating and drinking and the med pass, that's in a different documentation system. And so we do need to figure out a way to communicate this day-to-day things between shifts and, the idiosyncrasies of dementia, that are challenging, and trying to maintain continuity of staff, because you'll see nursing assistants, they change so frequently. And with a patient with dementia who's nonverbal, when you, if you've, I'm sure you have talked to nursing staff, they're like, well, Mrs. Jones, here's what she does when she's in pain. Well, how do you, it, how do you share those idiosyncrasies? And so, talking about families, it's so important to rely on families, because, you can ask a daughter, how does your mom show us that she's in pain? But again, where does a facility document that information, that crucial information? It's nowhere in the chart. It's in your head and you just know it. So I agree with you, keeping some type of notebook for people to be able to flip through. It's a continual difficulty that we definitely have with this group.
Very well said. Well, Dr. Dawson, we very much appreciate you coming on the show and sharing your knowledge with us today.
Well, thanks, Rob. I appreciate it.
Well, folks, I hope you found this episode educational. If you have an idea for a topic that you would like for me to discuss, please let me know. If you have an idea for someone that you would like for me to talk to, please let me know that as well. Also, be sure to enter to win the Nursing Home Abuse Podcast coffee mug. Still got 2 boxes of these things at the house. Please. I mean, you don't even have to enter the contest. Just email me. Just shout out the window. Give me a mug. I will give it to you. I have to get rid of these things. New episodes of the Nursing Home Abuse Podcast come out every single Monday. And with that, folks, we'll see you next time. Thanks for tuning in to the Nursing Home Abuse Podcast. Nothing said on this podcast, either by the host or the guest, should be construed as legal or medical advice, nor is intended to create an attorney-client relationship between the host or their guest and the listener. New episodes, for now, are available every other Monday on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or on your favorite podcast app, as well as on YouTube and our website, nursinghomeabusepodcast.com. Again, that's nursinghomeabusepodcast.com. See you next time.